Hello, Linecook Nation. This is Ray DeLucci with the Linecook Thoughts Podcast. Before we begin, just a reminder that we are running 40 miles to help raise funds and awareness for World Central Kitchen. The goal is to raise money to honor the 40 million meals served in COVID-19 relief. So that's why we're running 40 miles. If you'd like to donate, please use the link in the show notes. And yeah, it would help us out a lot, any amount you could give. But we are trying to raise funds for this organization because it's something I truly believe in. They really inspire me, and I do believe in the work that Jose Andres and the rest of the team does. So please use the link if you are interested. My guest today is Lori Wuhlever. She is a writer and editor and New York Times bestselling author who spent nearly a decade assisting Anthony Bourdain, with whom she co-authored Appetites, a cookbook, and the New York Times number one bestseller, World Travel, An Irreverent Guide. She has written about food and travel for the New York Times, GQ, Food and Wine, Lucky Peach, Savoir, Descent, Roads and Kingdoms, and others, and has worked as an editor at Art Culinaire and Wine Spectator. Her most recent book, the New York Times bestseller, Bourdain, the Definitive Oral Biography, was published by Echo in September 2021. I do highly recommend it. I did get to read it. It's a great book. It has a ton of firsthand accounts from people close to Anthony Bourdain and his life. And as we talk about in the episode, there are so many relevant topics that I think I didn't really know about Anthony Bourdain until I read the book, such as his battle with imposter syndrome, or just all, you know, a bunch of details that I had never really known about him. And as someone who looked up to him, I thought that it was very important to read. Before I kind of talk about our interview, I did want to say that, you know, Anthony Bourdain has a legacy that he left behind for so many. He inspired me to just be more aware of the world around me, to talk to people in the food industry. Obviously, you know, that's what I do is Line Cook Thoughts. And a big part of that is just an inspiration from him to show that everyone in the industry does have a story to tell, that this industry is not just made up of, you know, just people going to work. There's so much more that lies behind someone behind a stove or working as a dishwasher. And so this really was an important interview for me. I really am grateful that Lori took the time to speak with me. In it, we talk about first her career, how she met Tony. Then we kind of get into Anthony Bourdain's legacy and topics such as imposter syndrome or traveling with Anthony Bourdain or the process of writing this book, the process of writing World Travel. She tells a lot of great stories. She has a lot of good insights into who he was. And I think overall, it was just a great interview because I was able to just talk about someone that I look up to so, so much. And also I was able to continue the conversation of the legacy he has for cooks and people in the food industry. I know how important he is to so many, and to be able to just share that importance and also to be able to kind of learn more about someone who impacts us all so much, I thought was just an honor. So Lori, thank you so much for coming on the show. I do hope for everyone listening that, you know, you do find value in this, and I do hope you go pick up the book. I do think it's worth the read. I think there's so much in there that teaches about Anthony Bourdain, and I do think that a lot of people will resonate with him, especially the moments of him being a cook. And you know, as we talk a lot about in the industry now, him kind of wondering, is this all there really is for me, or is there more for me? So definitely go check it out. Lori, thank you so much for coming on the show. And here we go. All right. Well, welcome to the show. If you'd like to just start out by introducing yourself, that'd be great.
Sure. So my name is Lori Wuhlever, and I am a writer and author, most recently of Bourdain, the Definitive Oral Biography. And earlier this year, I published World Travel, An Irreverent Guide, which was co-authored with Anthony Bourdain.
Awesome. Great. Well, a ton of questions for the interview. But I you know, would like to start out by asking you kind of about your path and kind of how you got into writing. When did you start to realize that you wanted to become a food writer? Or when did you start to have a love for food?
So I always wanted to be a writer, but I wasn't really sure how to go about doing that. And I mean that, you know, since I was in elementary school, I knew that was something that I wanted to do. But I also knew that it was something that was not a path to financial solvency. I'm sure I didn't put it in those terms when I was in elementary school, but I knew that I needed to do something else and not just be a writer in terms of being able to support myself. So I studied natural resources in college. I thought maybe I would be an environmental writer. And then as it turned out, that wasn't really that interesting to me in the long term. I worked as a private cook right after college for 2 years for a family. I didn't really have any training as a cook. I really just read cookbooks. And as it turned out, the family that I worked for just wanted very, very simple food. So I was able to meet their needs without having too much skill and no training whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And at some point I realized that I wanted to actually learn to cook for real. I wanted to be able to cook on a more professional level. I was already taking writing classes at that point, trying to do some fiction writing and some essays. And then I thought, well, if I learn to cook and then maybe I can be a food writer. Again, you know, not a path to financial solvency, but but something that I could at least, get a start on. So I did go to cooking school at the French Culinary Institute in Manhattan. It was just a 6-month program, very intense. And I started looking for jobs in restaurants. But pretty much right away, I knew that really from the first couple of days of cooking school, I realized that I wasn't necessarily cut out to be a restaurant cook, or it wasn't the kind of cooking that I wanted to do. And in some ways, I thought I wish I had known that before I spent the time and money to go to cooking school. But I'm actually really glad that I did get that training and have that experience, even though I knew restaurant cooking wasn't for me, just because I was a little too soft, to be frank. You know, I was a little sensitive and also kind of lazy. And I realized that if I, you know, this is a job that you have to really love and really, really commit to. The rewards are not necessarily financial. It's really more about just the satisfaction of the craft. I have the utmost respect for cooks and chefs. And I just thought, I'm not sure that I have enough of the passion for this job in me to do what it takes. But so I ended up getting a job with Mario Batali. And this was back in the end of 1998. And so he was on television. He had just opened his second restaurant in New York, and he was looking for an assistant. He had also just published his first book. So I was the right combination of knowing how to cook and being interested in writing and being, you know, young and kind of willing to learn and do a bunch of different types of jobs to be his assistant. I think I was also the only person who applied for the job, so it made it really easy for him to decide to hire me. And that was a great and formative experience. And I know people have lots of feelings about Mario and the sort of downfall that he had a couple of years ago, and, you know, very unfortunate. But at that time, this was, you know, several over 20 years ago. This was for me a really useful, if not always 100% pleasant, but a very useful and sometimes very fun and educational experience to be his assistant. And I got to do a lot of food writing with and for him. And I started working as a freelance writer on the side, just pitching stories and doing as much writing as I could for local New York publications and eventually some national publications. And when I left that job working with Mario, he introduced me to Tony Bourdain, who had a few years before that published Kitchen Confidential. And Mario and Tony became friends by virtue of being food media celebrities in New York and about the same age. And so Tony hired me to help him with his first cookbook, Kitchen Confidential. So that's kind of my origin story in food writing.
Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. So before we go further into food writing, a couple questions, and I'm looking down at some notes, so not
sure. Yeah.
I was reading about your bio, and also I read that you had like positions such as a video store clerk and like farmhand positions. Mm-hmm. Were these kind of also during when you were trying to become a food writer, or did these happen before that?
So, I mean, I've been working part-time or full-time. I started working when I was 14, just because, you know, you wanted to earn money, right? And my parents mm-hmm. felt very strongly that it was important to learn a good work ethic and to understand what it is to be an employee and to earn money for college and spending money. So my first job was as a bus girl in a local restaurant where I was growing up. That was my first experience in the restaurant industry. And then I worked in a video store after that, which was a much cushier, easier job. And, you know, it was a cool job, and this was back in the early 90s when there were such thing as video stores where you would go and rent VHS tapes to watch on your VCR. so I did that in high school. And then also when I was in college, I worked part-time at a number of different jobs. And one of those was also in a video store. So those were just, you know, jobs that a student could have for 15, 20 hours a week and make a little cash. And then I got work on farms in the summertime between years of college. I went to school. I went to Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and there's a lot of farmland right immediately outside the university area. A lot of dairy farms and also a lot of vegetable farming that goes on. So I had jobs at two different organic vegetable and flower farms, and it was really hard work. It was hot. It was long hours. And I really, really loved it. And I learned so much about fruits and vegetables and herbs and agriculture and a little bit about the business of selling locally. And it was a fantastic experience. Again, not a path to get rich. I have yet to really put myself on a path of guaranteed payoffs, but I always tend to find work that I really love. So I did that for a number of years. And then once I graduated college, my very first job before I got the private cook job was I worked for about 2 months at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. And that, again, was sort of an extension of that love of agriculture and gardening and plants and outdoor work. But, again, did not pay well and those were very long hours. And it was a bit of an ego blow for me to go from being a college student and, you know, relatively pampered life of a college student to pulling weeds and picking up trash and, you know, pitching hay in a botanic garden. I found it to be a little bit, it wasn't exactly where I wanted to go in life. So I kind of switched paths.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Yeah, I just ask about that because I noticed some of it was with food and it just was kind of a cool theme. And then obviously video store clerk isn't so much with food, but it's a job.
Yeah, well,
so.
we did make popcorn and sell candy. So there was a slight food element.
Yes. Awesome. And one more thing, kind of, you know, looking into your background, I wasn't really sure of the context, but you had a chef give you a piece of advice, Chef Pascal Barrick. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I figured it was something like that. I didn't want to attempt it. The quote is, "Don't freak out. Freaking out is not going to help." I definitely need to take this advice. But do you have a backstory behind this quote?
Yeah, he was my first and my favorite instructor at cooking school. He had the probably not enviable position of having the first round students. I think the entire block of cooking school was broken up into four units. And so he had the unit one students who really were just very, very new. And a lot of us were very nervous and didn't know what we were doing. And he just said very early on, and probably within the first week, when I'm sure one of us or more of us were freaking out about something, you know, in this high, what we thought was a high stress environment. Although looking back, cooking school was pretty relaxed compared to an actual, you know, restaurant kitchen, but you didn't know that. And he just said in his like heavy French accent, "Don't freak out. Freaking out's not going to help," you know, meaning just like whatever's going on, whatever your challenge is in the kitchen, you're not going to make it any better by yelling and screaming, throwing things, you know, getting everyone around you upset. It's only going to, you know, just add static to the atmosphere. And just try and keep a calm head, take a breath, keep your head down, do your work, you know. Really good advice and oftentimes really difficult advice to take. You know, it's very easy to let your emotions kind of take over in a high stress environment like a kitchen. So I really just appreciated that somebody was willing to counter that narrative and to say like, there's, you know, just keep your head and just, you know, do your best.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely have taken that advice. Do need to take it more. Definitely is interesting. But yeah, no, I thought it was a cool quote, so I figured I'd ask. Mm-hmm. So, you kind of mentioned or you shared how you met Anthony Bourdain, and so what was it like the first few years working with him or meeting with him, and how did you kind of kept you in a place where you continued to write with him?
So my first impressions of him, I was surprised, and this gets touched on in the book, in Bourdain, the definitive oral biography, that a lot of people, expected the guy that you saw on the page in Kitchen Confidential to be the guy that you met in real life, right? This brash, funny, cursing, maybe he's smoking a cigarette. You know, you think he's going to show up and be this like wild cowboy, you know? And that was not the case when I first met him. And really throughout my time of knowing him, I mean, he was, he could be very quiet and soft-spoken, a little bit shy, a little bit awkward, you know, sometimes seemed like he just wanted to get out of there. He was just, you know, in a hurry to get a meeting done and to move on with his day. So he was very, very kind and very polite, but not the sort of character that he could present himself on the page and sometimes on camera. You know, he was a much more nuanced and low-key person than his written persona might suggest. So we worked really well together on that cookbook. It was mostly by email because he was already making a cook's tour for television and he was really, really busy and traveling a lot. So we did most of our work by email in getting the recipes, you know, edited and scaled down and tested for that book. And then that was kind of it for a while. You know, he wrote a really beautiful hyperbolic part about me in the acknowledgments of that book. And then I went on to work at Art Culinaire magazine and then later at Wine Spectator magazine. And he went on to, you know, make more television and write more books. And he had an assistant. And then there was one time where his assistant, Beth, was pregnant and she couldn't travel and he needed somebody to go with him to do an event in Montana. It was some speaking and some cooking demos and a private dinner. And so he asked me to come along for that. And that went really well. And, you know, I was able to help him out with what he needed. And, you know, we got along really well. And then I was in the position of looking for a part-time job. And I reached out to Tony because we had this, you know, these good working experiences. And I reached out to many other people and just said, you know, I had a baby. I need to work part-time. You know, here's what I can do. And just please keep me in mind if you hear of anything. And he was the first and I think only person that wrote back to me and said, you know, as it turns out, my assistant's leaving. You know, would you be interested in taking that job? And I was like, yes, of course. You know, at that point, I had been an editor for a couple of years, and I wasn't sure. I think if anybody else had said, do you want to be my assistant? I would say, I think I'm too old, or I think that's kind of like I've gone beyond that now. But because it was Tony, I was like, yes, definitely. And so I started working for him. So that was in 2009, and I continued to be his assistant all the way through to 2018. And, you know, he knew I was a writer and wanted to sort of keep my mind sharp and wasn't going to be just satisfied just doing the sort of admin tasks that really are asked of an assistant. So he always was giving me sort of extra stuff to do. And one of those things was editing books on his imprint that he had called Anthony Bourdain Books that was part of Echo, which was his publisher. And then later, you know, he gave me the opportunity to write a cookbook with him that we started in 2014. Published it in 2016. That's called Appetites, a Cookbook. And there were just always, you know, there was always enough to keep my mind engaged and to keep me, you know, satisfied doing the sort of more ground level tasks of an assistant.
Awesome. In reading the book, a big piece of content for me or a big thing I push with Line Cook Thoughts has been the idea of making sure people are okay with expanding into the industry. For example, when I was like a cook, I wanted to do more, but I often had this like imposter syndrome that if I left cooking or left kitchens, I would be my value would lessen as a person. Mm-hmm. And as I've done this brand for about 2.5 years now, I've had a bunch of people reach out to me like talking about leaving kitchens or wanting to pursue something else. Maybe it's family life. Maybe they're just burnt out. And I wrote an article and it like got a lot of, you know, traction just because this topic is like really important to a lot of people. And I really found it interesting in reading the biography. And I don't want to misquote it, but the idea that Anthony Bourdain kind of, I don't want to say feared, but was worried about being a line cook the rest of his life. And I just wondering if you could touch on that. Cause for me, that was like very interesting. I think a lot of people feel that sentiment. Mm-hmm. And while obviously he loved cooking or, you know, he showed that he loved cooking and he's like a hero to any single line cook in the industry. Mm-hmm. I thought it was an interesting point that he too wanted obviously to see more and do more and have more of an impact, I think it seems so.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, he talked about it in life, he definitely made no secret of the fact that he was starting to get burned out and scared and frankly tired. I mean, as you know, being a cook is a very physically demanding job, and it takes its toll on your knees and your back. And, you know, if you partake in all the extracurriculars, it takes its toll on your liver and your lungs. And, you know, you don't see people working till 65 on the line very often, mm-hmm. you know? So what do you do, you know, when your body starts to give out and you're burned out and you're not able to spend enough time with your family? I think it remains a big question for people. It's not necessarily the most sustainable career all the way through to retirement age. So what, I guess some people go and work in country clubs, or some people go teach, or, you know, work in an institutional setting where the hours are a little kinder and it's, you know, less of a toll on your mental and physical health. And some people do just get out of the business altogether. I think it was, for him, I think it was a struggle of, you know, he loved it. It was a love-hate thing. You know, he loved the camaraderie and he loved the banter and the life of a line cook. There was a lot that was appealing to him, but there was also this financial insecurity, this physical, you know, exhaustion, and this sense of, well, what do I do? You know, what does my life look like after I can no longer, you know, bend down one more time to reach into the low boy? And so I think he was always writing something with a sense of, you know, hoping, trying to actually write his way out of the kitchen. And I think that he thought at first it was going to be these novels. You know, he wrote and published two crime novels before he wrote Kitchen Confidential. And they were both with, you know, major publishers, but they were modest sales successes, certainly nothing that would allow him to, you know, financially be able to leave his job. So, you know, Kitchen Confidential was a sort of third time's the charm. You know, it was the right book at the right time with the right publisher, written by someone who also had an extraordinary talent and an extraordinary way with words.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And kind of tying into that, the idea of imposter syndrome, this is chapter 53, where imposter syndrome kind of takes the lead in this chapter. And it's, you know, a little short. And for people who haven't read the book yet, it's like quotes from others sharing about Anthony Bourdain's life, which I found like a really cool setup for how the book was written. But this idea of imposter syndrome, it affects so many people in the industry, cooking, not cooking, and just, I don't know, maybe it doesn't have to necessarily relate to him, but why do you think, as someone who's observed people in restaurants and obviously has written about people in restaurants, why do you think imposter syndrome affects us so hard in the food world?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, we're constantly looking at what other people are doing, right? I mean, especially now with social media, it's like you can see what everybody else's menu looks like, what their dishes look like, you know, who's in the kitchen, you know, who's doing well, who's getting great reviews, who's not. I mean, everything's kind of out there. It becomes this kind of constant competition, right? And you only see what people want you to see. You don't really see the whole story, you know? So it's very easy to be like, oh, they got the ramps this week, we didn't get our ramps yet, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, I can't believe they're doing that. That's from 5 years ago. Or, you know, I know he stole that recipe from a place I used to work at. I mean, there's just so much opportunity for kind of forgetting half the story and for assuming that somebody else is doing better. And I think also there's this sense of like, how much of quote unquote normal life you miss out on as a cook, as somebody who works in the restaurant business. I mean, you're missing holidays and weekends and family time. And, you know, you get in this, your bubble of the kitchen, which is great. And which is, you know, can feel like a family in the best ways. But, there's that idea of what am I missing out on, you know, it's such a, it's like, what is that line from, was it The Godfather 2? Just when I thought they was out, they pulled me back in. You know, I mean, there's such a pull that this industry has on people's minds and hearts, you know? And so I think there's, when you're so ensconced in something that's like a family, there's kind of a self-reinforcing idea that like, this is where I'm safe. This is where I can do my best work. This is where I need to be. And I don't know what's out there. I don't know what normal life is like. I don't know what like a different type of industry is like. You know, there's a lot of fear, I think, that drives that sense of imposter syndrome. So it's a lot of different things, but I think it's very, very common. And, you know, like you said, and there's a chapter in the book about Tony having imposter syndrome. And I think it's just really helpful to remember that even someone like him, who had all these outward trappings of success, you know, was a best-selling author, et cetera, et cetera, he felt like just as big an imposter as anyone else, you know, mm-hmm. He really did. I was with him backstage before he went on to do a speaking engagement in 2016. It was the end of the book tour for our cookbook. And it was a sold out house. And he had done, you know, every single appearance he did on this like 15 city book tour was a sold out house of 2,000 or 3,000 seats of people wanting to hear him talk and have him sign their books. And this was the last one. And he was like, oh, God, I feel like such a fraud. I can't believe that people have come and paid money to hear me just like say my bullshit. I was like, what? You're literally Anthony Bourdain. Like, what are you talking about? You know, but it's like it didn't matter. Yeah. You know, I think there's always, especially for writers too, I think it's like, you know what you think you can do, you know what the best work you can possibly do, you can imagine in your mind, and you never quite get there. And maybe that's the same for cooks and chefs too. You've seen the most perfect ideal dishes, you know, whatever it is, World's 50 Best or Bocuse d'Or or any of these things where you're getting to lay eyes on what's considered the world's best cooking, the world's best dish or the world's best chef. And all you can do is try and live up to that ideal, but you know, nothing is perfect. And of course, for every Bocuse d'Or winner, there's like a dozen losers, right? So, or, you know, for every World's 50 Best, there's, you know, 1,000 that are also really, really good, you know, but didn't make that list. So we're all kind of constantly comparing ourselves to each other, and it's to our detriment, really.
Yeah. I totally agree. And you kind of mentioned food writers. Have you ever faced imposter syndrome in your career?
Every day, today. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. You know, I mean, it doesn't, I think that's what's important to remember is it doesn't end. You know, I don't know that there's any mark of success where somebody goes, okay, that's it. I'm done. I've done it. You know, I mean, maybe, mm-hmm. I don't know. I would love to meet that person that feels like they've like done the thing and there's nothing else to do. I mean, that's part of being alive. It's part of sort of the drive of life, right? Is to continue to try and top yourself. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just published this book and I'm like, got very caught up in the, you know, is it going to hit the New York Times bestseller list? And how many copies did I sell? And you know, what other books came out? You know, just this, it's, you know, it's human, it's natural. It's like competition and trying to understand how well one is doing by measuring oneself against everyone else's success. So it's a recipe for, you know, it's crazy making, you know, so I try and keep a handle on it, but I think it's part of the human condition.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, everyone struggles with that. And also, I mean, this book is obviously about someone you know, care about and you want to do right by. So I could even see the, you know, just that pressure. Mm-hmm. So I kind of have a quick story about Anthony Bourdain. So I'm 24. I grew up kind of just knowing about him on TV. My mom was always like, oh, Bourdain. But my dad was like, oh, Bourdain's cool. So it's kind of like this like mix of like watching him on TV. And I remember before I went to culinary school, I went to the CIA. My dad bought me Kitchen Confidential. And I remember like one of the coolest stories I read was him keeping like stock paste in his coat. Mm. And like he had like put that into, I think it was like a stock or a soup, and he like got really good marks on it. I thought, I don't know, I was just like, I don't know if I have the guts to do this, but I think it's a good idea if I ever need to.
Yeah.
But there was a moment in the CIA where I actually got to see him speak. It was in 2018. Or 2017. I believe it was 2018. It was for a graduation. And he came back to the CIA and he gave a speech for the graduating class. And I wasn't graduating. I actually snuck into the auditorium. I knew someone who let me in. I got to stand in the back. And it really just struck me at how cognizant he was of the time and of what was going on. This is obviously when Me Too was really like, you know, happening in the industry with chefs that, you know, were very disgraceful and treated people poorly. And to have him, someone, an icon of food, who really didn't have to bring it up, like go up on stage and kind of just be like, you know, he like addressed everyone in the room. He was like, especially like the men in the room, like we have a responsibility to make this industry better. And it wasn't just all that. It was just like mental health, taking care of yourself. And I just like really, that stuck with me. Maybe it's a big reason why like I started to like realize mental health and like taking care of yourself is important. But being able to like see him live and have just hear him be so relevant in the moment, I thought was so fascinating. Because like I said, like he was so successful at that point, he didn't have to really touch on anything that was a difficult topic. Was he always like that, to where he was super like relevant and like just like always like saying in the know, like just being in the know of the moment?
He and his producers, I will say, had a remarkable knack for showing up in places all around the world where something was about to happen or something was happening in that moment. And maybe it was a place that had been kind of quiet in the news. And then suddenly there's, you know, a student revolution, or, you know, he and his crew showed up in Beirut in 2006, and they were there for a couple of days. And then suddenly there's a war with Israel. And I mean, it was not a happy occasion for them. You know, they were stuck in the country. The airport was shut down and bombed. They had to be evacuated on a Navy ship. I mean, it was a very tense and difficult situation for them. And so that's an extreme example. But he had a really extraordinary way of kind of being in the right place at the right time. And he was, you know, he was a voracious reader. He was a voracious observer of the news, of world events. He was really able to kind of string things together, disparate elements of you know, history and present day politics. So yeah, he's somebody who really had his finger on the pulse. And I think with regard to Me Too and the way that things were going in restaurants and kitchens and media and a lot of industries in 2017, I mean, he was very, I think he felt a sense of responsibility. You know, he had written Kitchen Confidential, which was so successful. And in some ways he felt that by 2017, he had outgrown some of the stories and the attitudes. And, you know, he found it to be a little bit obnoxious. And there were some things that he regretted that were really just a reflection of the time. You know, when the time period he was writing about, the 80s and 90s, were a very different time in restaurant kitchens and in workplaces in general. And I think he felt some sense of, he wanted to make very clear that he didn't endorse some of the, you know, the sexism that pervades the industry, and that his attitude, that he had matured and changed in some ways. Now, I think you'll see in the book that, you know, he wasn't really ever that guy. You know, he might have had his vices and his faults, but he wasn't that guy around women in the kitchen. You know, he had a real genuine respect for women and as co-workers, and it just, that wasn't his problem. But I think he felt responsible for having been friends and for having promoted certain men in the industry who, unbeknownst to him, were maybe not the greatest bosses and colleagues. Mm-hmm. And I think he felt a sense of wanting to right that wrong as much as he could. I think he was surprised by some of the things that were revealed in that time period, and he wanted to do what he could and use his platform to, you know, to encourage people to do better.
Yeah. Yeah, and I did find that interesting in the book too. You did have an interview or a couple interviews in kind of the beginning section of, you know, females in the kitchen being like, you know, he never really was that way. And so, you know, I thought it was, obviously I knew it was an important topic to him when he spoke about it, but I think reading it, like just seeing firsthand accounts of how he was in the kitchen, you're right, like obviously he did have his vices, and, you know, from what I read, he did act a certain way, but it was never like, it didn't seem like it was like intentional or like taking advantage of anyone. It was like, just a part of the era where, you know,
yeah, I think the people who probably got the worst of him were waiters, you know, and whether they were probably mostly men, you know, as would be also befit the era, you know, and it wasn't true abuse. It was just sort of you know how it goes between back of the house and front of the house. I mean, there's some level of resentment around, you know, pay disparities and long hours So I think he probably, as a chef, probably was, you know, reserved his most sort of caustic attitude for waiters that he might have seen as being lazy or you know, and certain individuals. I don't think he never dismissed an entire category of workers as lazy. But, you know, as the chef, you want a waiter with a little pep in their step who's going to show up and run the food and make sure it gets hot to the tables.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you for sharing that as well. Yeah, you know, I thought, you know, I think it was interesting too, obviously, going into reading World Travel. I really enjoyed that book as well. I got COVID the end of August. Oh. Vaccinated, had a breakthrough case, so it was mild, but I was still like fatigued and, you know, not feeling the greatest. And I read World Travel in preparation for this, obviously, but just also to read it. I've been meaning to read it. A little sad that Buffalo, New York didn't make it in the book, because that's my, I'm kidding, but I don't think it needs to be in the book. I love the city, but yeah, I thought the book was great. And I don't know, I really enjoyed how you put it together, like his quotes and your quotes. What was it like putting that book together? Because it's so extensive in the details. Like, I just remember reading the travel section, like how to like arrive at the airport and get a taxi. And I was just like, I can't, like, the amount of work you must have put in just for those sections alone is probably insane.
Yeah, it was a lot of work for sure. You know, that book was tough because it was something that Tony and I started working on together before he died. You know, we came up with it in 2017, and then we put the contract together and got the publisher to agree to it, and then really started in earnest to put it together in the spring of 2018. And so it was meant to be a true collaboration, and he had, you know, big plans to write a bunch of essays for it. And it was something we were going to do together. It was our second book together. And I had a lot of fun doing Appetites with him. And I had every reason to think that this would be the same experience. So to be tasked with finishing that book after he died on my own was difficult and was lonely. It was a lot of work. And I had to make decisions that we would have made together. And I had to sort of figure out how to get his voice in there without him providing, you know, the new writing that I had hoped he would do. So the great thing is that I had access to all of the transcripts from all the television that he ever made. And then, of course, all of the writing he did. And I had liberty to use those words in the book. So there's a lot of Tony's voice in there, just sort of packaged in a different way that really, you know, speaks to the travel guide format. And as far as those details of, you know, how to get to a place, what's the airport like? And you know, I got a little pushback from some readers who were like, why would you include all of this? You know, but I think that, you know, airports can be really interesting, just not even necessarily the airport themselves, which are all kind of the same more or less, but you know, where is an airport in relation to the city and what is it called? And what does that say about the history of a place? And you know, what countries or cities are or are not served by that airport? And what does that say about geopolitics? And, you know, there's just a lot of sort of, it's sort of a secret code in a way, like what, you know, what an airport says about a place that you're going to. And it's your first point of contact with a place. And, you know, is there public transportation to and from the airport? And what does that say about how the government values its citizens or how the government does or doesn't spend its resources? So, you know, you can always, if that's not interesting to you, you can always skip over it. But I think those details of travel and trains and all of that kind of stuff, and, you know, the different codes around, you know, taxis and tipping and, you know, all of that stuff is to me really interesting. And, you know, that was always a point of contention with Tony, you know, if it was a good airport with good food, which is rare, but there are some, you know, he loved the Singapore airport. That just is basically like a little city, you know, with hotels and showers, a movie theater and all kinds of restaurants. You know, you can get a massage, you can take a nap. It's, you know, it's amazing. So, it was a lot of work, and it was in some ways very, very lonely, but I also did have a lot of help from my colleagues who made television with Tony. So that was great to be able to ask them questions about their experiences of traveling to different places.
Yeah. Like I said, I really enjoyed it. It was very, being quarantined for 14 days to have a book like that and be able to read it and kind of feel like I was going somewhere when I really couldn't go anywhere. It was like the perfect time to read it. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I used to live in Chicago for some time. I really enjoyed the Chicago section. I have been to Pasadena before, and I definitely have a few places on my list to go visit when I go back to visit in the next few months. But yeah, and so going into this book, I would love to ask first off, did you choose the cover photo, or how, like, what was the artwork for the biography like?
Yeah, there was definitely a committee process. There were many iterations. You know, there's lots and lots of photos available of Tony. You know, having done so much television, and the networks would often send a photographer on location to take, you know, extra photos. So there was a lot to choose from, but we wanted to have something that fell somewhere between serious and pensive, but not super tragic or dark or depressing. You know, the end of his life obviously is a very tragic thing, but he lived a full and in some ways really joyous life. And so I think the obvious thing would have been to have a very serious, kind of dark and craggy close-up photo of the man, you know, in his last year or so of life. But I think what we've got here, which is a photo of him looking really handsome, is in Beirut, when he went back to Beirut. I think it was in 2015, and he's, you know, he looks serious, but he's not, he doesn't look tragic. He's, you know, he looks thoughtful. I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of, elements of decision that go into putting, you know, a cover of a book together. You know, you want it to catch somebody's eye. You want it to be appealing. You know, you want it to sort of tell the story of what's going on inside. So I'm very happy with it. And then inside there are two really full photo inserts with a lot of photos from his family. Tony's mother, Gladys, who died in 2020, she was a tremendous record keeper. So his brother, Christopher, invited me over to look at the family photo albums, and they were just meticulous. You know, every photo with a date and the name, first and last name of every person that was in the photo and where they were and what the occasion was. It was really, really an amazing archive. So there's a lot of family photos in the book, and then photos that go all the way through to the rest of Tony's life.
Awesome. Yeah. I enjoyed seeing the CIA photos. Definitely. Let's see Roth Hall. Was cool. Yeah. I'm weird. So I take this off of hardcover books when I read them, but just holding it up so everyone could see the picture if you're watching this on YouTube. I definitely was just like, I thought it was a cool picture, and I thought it was like very, so kind of just going back to it. So then you obviously, just like choosing the style of how you wrote the biography, I in the beginning of the episode, I thought it was really cool that it's all quotes, like firsthand accounts from people throughout his life. What was the process like? Well, first off, what was your decision for that? Instead of kind of narrating his life, why was it important for you to have like firsthand accounts lead the way?
Well, you know, this format, the oral biography format, really kind of reflects the way that Tony was a storyteller. You know, once he got through Kitchen Confidential, writing his own story, he went out into the world and started asking people questions about their lives. And he was really good at going into a place, you know, with some knowledge, asking questions, and then sitting back and letting people tell their own story in their own way. And so we thought that this oral biography really would be a sort of homage to that aspect of Tony and his creative process. And, you know, there are so many people from so many different parts of his life with different perspectives and different time periods. And it just made sense to let them really tell their own stories. And, you know, the more I got into the process of doing these interviews, the more it just it really kind of affirmed that there was not much to be gained in kind of flattening down the narrative into my own.
Do you, when you were going back, I'm sure there's obviously so many memories for you, you know, really, like working with him. Do you have any, like,
the best,
did you have like a favorite memory that kept popping up as you wrote the story, or like any particular moments that kept, were just like, I don't know, there for you while writing this project?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had a couple of really great trips with Tony, and I mean, those are not in the book, but that experience is definitely reflected in world travel. Tony, you know, but the larger spirit of generosity that even spurred Tony to offer me these trips is definitely very evident in the biography. It was probably 3 or 4 years into my working with him. And Tony said, well, do you want to travel along with us, with the crew? You know, you can choose a location from the list for the season and I'll pay your expenses and you can just go along and hang out and, you know, watch us work or, you know, do whatever you want. If you want to pitch a magazine story, you know, about the place that we're in, you can do that. And it's just this really, really generous offer that I definitely took him up on. So I always think of those trips where, you know, just that spirit of generosity, that spirit of wanting to share his good fortune with as many people as possible around him. So the first time I took one of those trips, it was in 2014. We went to Vietnam, to the central part of the country in a city called Hue. And, you know, it was just so special to go to this country, Vietnam, where he had been so many times and he really loved it. But to see this city for the first time with him, he had never been to Hue. And to see it through his eyes and for him to encourage me to kind of, you know, go beyond my comfort zone. And he had a scooter. They would always rent him a scooter in Vietnam so that he could just get back and forth to locations. And he just made him really, really happy to drive a scooter around these like busy city streets. So he had me ride along with him on the scooter. And, you know, it just, to me, just kind of encompasses all of that generosity of spirit and sure that, you know, pushing people, you know, a little bit beyond their comfort zone.
Experiences eating with him and
that true,
you know, getting to try new food.
Joy sure, that he had.
How was he just like sitting down in a restaurant?
Really,
I mean, someone so famed
special
for working in restaurants and talking about restaurants. What was it like to like sit down with Anthony Bourdain to just like eat a meal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, my experiences were mostly like, you know, in the hotels and the places where I would go along, you know, with the crew. He was really, really into breakfast, like a hotel breakfast, a fancy hotel breakfast. He loved a breakfast buffet and he would try and like draw it out as long as possible. And was just seemed really happy and really comfortable. And even if people approached him, which would happen once in a while, he was very cool about it and very generous with his time. And, you know, he just, I just saw him very relaxed and happy with a baguette with tons of butter and jam, several cups of coffee, a cigarette if he was smoking at that time, and we, you know, especially if we were sitting outdoors, you know, he'd be smoking. And then, you know, one of the greatest experiences I had with him was in Tokyo, and it was really, really a simple place. It was in 2016. Mm-hmm. He and I took the bullet train across Japan from Kanazawa to Tokyo one day, and the crew was driving the equipment across the country in big vans, but we took the train, had a bento box lunch on the train, which was really cool. You know, just beautiful service, just really, really elegant. And then we got to Tokyo and got to our hotel. We stayed at the Park Hyatt, which is very famously featured in the film Lost in Translation. So just a beautiful hotel. And he didn't have to shoot a scene that night because the crew was still making their way across the country. And he said, well, do you want to go just grab some yakitori? So we just got into a cab and went to Shinjuku, which is kind of a fun, loud, kind of young part of Tokyo, and just went into the first yakitori place we could find. It was nothing special. We hadn't, you know, consulted the producers. It wasn't like some wild, you know, back alley thing. It was just a very simple and very good chicken yakitori place. And he ordered, you know, all the parts. And we just sat there and drank beer and ate grilled chicken. And nobody bothered him. Nobody recognized him. He was just a guy enjoying a simple night out in Tokyo. And it was, again, he was happy. He was, I had never been to Tokyo before. So again, it was like, let me show you this city that I love and that I've been to a million times. And then we went across the street and had ramen, which was probably overkill after eating all that chicken. But it was like, well, you know, we're here. We're in Tokyo. You got to get ramen. And then we walked around. There's a neighborhood called the Golden Guy, which is a series of a very small, close together little streets. And there's all these bars, just one after the other, these tiny little bars that have maybe 3 or 4 bar stools at a bar and maybe 2 other seats, these little tiny bars. And in some cases, you walk in and you go up a ladder to the second story. It's this really interesting experience. You kind of look in and they all have different themes. And it's just, it's just, I've never seen anything like it. And he loved it. You know, this was like one of the first places he visited his first time in Tokyo, and he would always go back. There was one specific bar, the Albatross Bar, that he loved, that he had had a really kind of a lost evening in and got pretty drunk when he was a much younger man. So again, just to see this place that's, you know, it's not a big secret. Yeah, it's a little bit touristy, but it was something that he genuinely loved and always wanted to go back to.
That's a big goal for me. I never had the opportunity to travel outside the U.S.
And those kinds of experiences really made a big impression on me.
I was actually set to go to Spain before COVID hit. So the goal is to start traveling now once, you know, since we have vaccines and everything else. But no, it sounds great. Kind of the last question around, you know, Anthony Bourdain is, and like you, what you observed. So obviously, over the last few years, mental health has been a big part of the industry. Self-care has been a big part of the industry. It's a big reason why I started this brand, to be honest. Just realizing that, you know, not just Anthony Bourdain, but just friends and colleagues struggling with cooking and myself, my own struggles. Like, you know, I've suffered from anxiety. I started therapy last year, like just taking it more seriously. But I really have seen, at least, you know, from my point of view and like the generation's point of view that I'm in, his impact really being one of self-care and just of being open to travel, being open to new people, not really judging, having that open mindset. And I've seen such a positive impact from the work he did, and it feels like the legacy that he leaves on. And, you know, all cooks obviously look up to him, and he's such like a reverent person in food. What have you witnessed as you've, you know, written the book, as you've gone over the last few years? Like his impact on cooks or people in the food industry in general, because I've just, for me, it's just like to see how people hold him and like to see the like legacy he's left behind. I mean, it's inspired me to pretty much create, you know, something I love doing, and it has. So, what have you seen?
Well, I think that by writing Kitchen Confidential and by shining a light on this industry that he loved, I think he did give a sense of legitimacy. I think he made cooks, a whole generation of people working in restaurants, feel really seen and really valued, and to really recognize that this is an amazing industry. I mean, there are some incredibly creative, smart, hilarious, warm, and wonderful people that make up the restaurant business, right? And like it's a tribe, and it's a calling in a way. And he really lent a kind of legitimacy to that, and a sense of like this is a craft. This is a beautiful sort of guild of people who are a little bit crazy and a little bit outside the norm, but doing something at the high level that they do it because they're passionate about it. You know, I don't know that he was someone who, I don't know that I ever heard him use the term self-care. You know, I think that he was from more of a generation of suck it up, buttercup, you know, and I wish that wasn't the case. But, you know, I think he wanted better working conditions for people. He wanted people to be treated with respect. He wanted people to be paid better. And to have benefits and to have all of the things that make this industry challenging. You know, I think he was a longtime advocate for you know, equality between the front and the back of the house, however that's achieved. And he really recognized the really, really hard, backbreaking work that it is to be a cook. And I think I think the stuff that goes along with that now, the idea of mental health services and mental health support and just a more humane way of running restaurants. I think he was absolutely in support of that, while still kind of celebrating that toughness, you know, that sort of characterizes the industry in the best and worst ways. You know, I mean, there's a pride in being tough and hardworking and resilient. And then there's also, I think it can be damaging, you know, when you sort of, there's that peer pressure to show up sick, you know, because there's nobody else that can do it, or, you know, all of those things that sort of, it's becomes almost a masochistic cycle. So, you know, as far as his legacy, I mean, I think he, again, sort of lent some legitimacy to an industry that was kind of overlooked. I think he inspired a lot of people to write and do creative projects, you know, like what you're doing, to talk about their own experiences, to figure out a way to sort of make something out of it, whether it's financially viable or not, but just to express oneself and to tell the stories and to try and shine a light on people who might not otherwise get a chance to tell their stories. In as much as he left us in a really tragic way, I think he left a lot of people with a lot more hope and a lot more imagination than maybe was the case before he started, sharing his gifts with the world. So I wish he were still here. I think he made a terrible mistake.
Being willing to talk. I mean, obviously
it's a profound loss for the world,
difficult.
But I'm really grateful for the
but
time
I would
that,
have
that I got
been remiss
to know
in
him
not sharing that
and was
because
lucky enough to work with him.
I just see a generation coming up who see him as someone who is very inspiring and just someone to look up to. And just, like you said, he does come from a different generation, and maybe self-care never was in his vocabulary, but it was kind of the actions and like the care he had for the individual, like a dishwasher, just anyone in general in the kitchen. That had an effect on me and obviously on a lot of people. So thank you for sharing that. Want to ask what is next for you with writing? I kind of know, but obviously if you could share, I know you're working on a book now, concerning Brett.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. So I'm co-authoring a book about bread with a baker named Richard Hart, who is British. But he spent 6 years as the head baker at Tartine in San Francisco, and now he has a place called Hart Bakery in Copenhagen, Denmark, and it's part of the Noma, and then transitioned into baking. So we're working on that book, and I'd like to just keep writing. I really enjoy this process, a long writing project. I'm working on kind of putting down my own stories and, whether that'll be a memoir or, a scripted series or, just, I think there's a lot of potential, a lot of stories still to be told. And I really, I love the craft of writing first and foremost. And then I'm also starting to do some public speaking. So hopefully when things get a little safer, with COVID, I'll be out, meeting people who love Tony, talking about these books, telling stories, answering questions, trying to carry on with that tradition. Awesome. That Tony started.
Well, any books you want, shared on the podcast. I definitely would love to read your, story of how you, write as someone who wants to be a food writer, is kind of getting into food writing. I don't necessarily think I'd call myself a food writer, but I think I find it interesting. Great. So I end all interviews the same way. I call my audience the Line Cook Nation. The idea being that we all get into the industry. Mm-hmm. I feel like through cooking or like a similar role. And so, we have this group of people that listen to the show, follow the page. They love cooking. They love just being in the industry. So now that you get to be on the show, or that you've been on the show, what does it mean for you to be able to speak to people in the industry that are trying to just like engage and learn more about each other?
I mean, I feel really, I'm always really glad to have, to talk to people in the industry. Calling back imposter syndrome, I always felt because I couldn't really, I chose not to hack it, or I didn't really feel like I could hack it as a line cook. I always feel like a bit of an imposter in that way. I've always been around restaurants and around chefs, but I never really felt like I paid my dues. I spent about a month as a line cook, quit unexpectedly, and I had the skills, but I was like the number two garde-manger, So I have a tremendous respect for cooks, for people in the industry who really have put in the sweat and the time and the, paid with their lives, to do this work. I love the sense of humor. I love that sense of camaraderie. And, I wouldn't be able to do what I do without the generosity of cooks and chefs who are willing to talk to me, share their recipes, provide inspiration by the work that they do. And some of my best friends are chefs and cooks. So, it's super thrilling, to be able to talk to people in the business.
Awesome. Where's the best place for people to find your book or purchase your book?
Well, you know, I've got to always shout out the independent bookstore. If you're still lucky enough to have one in your town, definitely check with them. If they don't stock it, they might order it for you. Barring that, you know, it's in all the usual places: Amazon, Walmart, Target. All the big retailers are stocking it. So whatever is easiest for you. But if you can support an independent bookstore, please give it a try. Kitchen Arts and Letters in Manhattan has a big stock of signed copies, and they will ship anywhere in the country. So if that's interesting to you, check out Kitchen Arts and Letters in New York City.
Just a book heaven. that's
yes. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Lori, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode. I did want to point out, it did cut out a little bit. The new book she is working on is with Chef Richard Hart. It's a book on bread. It's going to be kind of everything a home baker will need to know about bread. So she did cut out a little bit there due to our connection. So I just wanted to point that out. I did want to thank Lori for coming on the show. I really do hope that you do pick up the Bourdain, the definitive oral biography book, because it is something that I think gives a really interesting spotlight into Anthony Bourdain's life. It really shines light to a lot of things that I think a lot of people go through that I really resonated with, such as the imposter syndrome we discussed. And I just think it's an incredible book with a lot of firsthand accounts of Anthony Bourdain. And if you're a fan of him, and like me, if you're just really impacted by the legacy he's left behind, I do think it is worth the read. Thank you all so much for listening to this podcast. Please don't forget, we are running to raise funds and awareness for World Central Kitchen. We're running 40 miles, so please use the link in the show notes to donate if you can. And I'll see you on the next Line Cook Thoughts podcast.